Wonder Woman, Wonder Woman, the whole world was waiting for you with trepidation, fearful that the big screen debut of one of DC Comics' most popular superheroes and feminist icon would be as tragically awful as the film Batman v Superman. Your mom was named Martha and hated Batman v Superman too?
Today we take a look at the all-new Wonder Woman film, a critical and commercial success, which proves that Hollywood has to update its idea of what it takes to make a box office hit.
Plus, Charles Fox and the wonderfully campy 1970s Wonder Woman TV theme song.
Chris Pratt becomes a gay porn star.
And Cyndi Lauper is writing a Broadway musical for the 80s classic film Working Girl. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Right now, you're listening to Feast of Fun because for the last 13 years, a listener just like you took the time to support this one-of-a-kind, in-depth programming. Won't you take a moment now to ensure that Feast of Fun is around for the future? Visit feastoffun.com/plus and become a member. Make a donation at feastoffun.com/donate or visit our store, feastoffun.com/store.
Is now the Wonder Woman.
Well, what I like about that theme song, it has a little bit of like that same kind of feel that the theme song to Jaws has. It has that kind of like you're expecting something.
Oh, because it's of the Tina Guo, the cellist from Shanghai, her cello playing, her electric cello playing.
And what's interesting too is, you know, Wonder Woman, this film is, you know, she's a feminist icon.
Yes.
For a while there, it was considered inappropriate for women to play the cello because they had to spread their legs open like whores.
They couldn't play. They had to get a more sensible instrument like the harp.
Yes.
Which they could just rest on their shoulders and keep their nice legs crossed.
Yes. Nice and tight.
You know, Warner Brothers Films is probably singing the Charles Fox theme song.
Mm.
And here's some of the lyrics. All our hopes are pinning on you and the magic that you do. Stop a bullet cold, make the axis fold, change your minds and change the world. But only now. She's changing the franchise from shitty to awesome.
Because it took in $100 million this weekend, right?
$115 million on the opening weekend, unprecedented for a female filmmaker, director. It has a 92% critical rating, which is the highest ever, especially for recently Warner Brothers films. Like, they've been not putting out a lot of turkeys. And, you know, Wonder Woman was directed by monster director Patty Jenkins. You guys probably most familiar with her other film, starring Charlize Theron, about Eileen Wuornos, the lesbian killer from Florida, based on the real life Eileen Wuornos.
And this movie absolutely crushed Tom Cruise's The Mummy, which I think they're saying is like Tom Cruise's worst movie ever.
I'm a mummy. Look at me. I scare people. Watch what happens when I walk up to someone. Ticker, ticker, ticker. I'm a mummy.
What is that song again?
That's a song called I'm a Mummy from the 1960s. It's from the album Incredibly Strange Music. It's a compilation, but you can find it on YouTube. I'm a Mummy.
And that album is an inspiration for our Christmas show, Incredibly Strange Christmas Music.
And I gotta say, Wonder Woman is a series that in the sound of it from the 1970s inspired a lot of the soundtrack and the background music of Feast of Fun. So a lot of the music that you guys hear on the show was actually composed around the same time in the mid 70s. And we managed to get ourselves a hold of a music library that was being used at that time period. And so the classic 1970s style that Charles Fox, who composed Laverne and Shirley's theme song, we're gonna do it, give us any rule, we'll break it, or the Happy days, you know, Sunday, Monday, Happy Days.
Oh, he did Tuesday, all Love American Style.
Love American Style.
Which Happy Days was a spinoff of that.
It was.
You know that. Yeah.
They were all spinoffs. And then the Love Boat was the way to get all those celebrities who didn't have jobs anymore to get them. And he composed the theme song to that, too, with Paul Anka.
He was super prolific.
And he also composed...
Was he not happy, though, with the Wonder Woman theme song? He wasn't very thrilled with it, was he?
Well, this is the thing. Before we get into talking about Wonder Woman, the new Wonder Woman, let's talk a little bit about the old Wonder Woman.
The one we fell in love with.
Originally, you know, and Wonder Woman is like an old friend of ours, you know, especially for gay men. We love Linda Carter's, you know, camp. Sexy, gorgeous sensibility from that TV show. Linda Carter, until Gal Gadot stepped onto the big screen, was Wonder Woman. And the sound, and what really, you know, won me over was the soundtrack, the background music of the original 70s TV series. And that was Charles Fox, who had a lot of commercial success as a songwriter. One of his biggest hits is Killing Me Softly with his song.
Theme song to the Bugaloos.
And the theme song to the Bugaloos.
Which he didn't know if he had actually written or not and then heard it, right?
Yeah, he had forgotten that he wrote it.
The Bugaloos,
we're in the air and everywhere, flying high. I can't believe that I actually know so many of the songs. And to me, like, Charles Fox, in many ways, composed the soundtrack to my life. Because as a little gay boy,
sure,
I got the sheet music to all these things, and I started learning how to play it.
Well, the other thing, too, is back in the day is, like, if you had a song from a TV show, a lot of times it would get airplay on the radio. Like, you'd hear the theme song to Happy Days or Laverne and Shirley. You hear it on the radio. Of course, it may have been a little bit of payola, but some people actually liked these songs. Like, they wanted to hear them on the radio.
And they were composed to be radio hits. So I think Charles Fox was a little disappointed that, you know, he really tried to make it something that people wanted to listen to. And, you know, it's disco music in a sense. And so the style could be easily replicated. And I think that was the challenge or the struggle. But, you know, that syncopated rhythm, which later seasons and later versions of the same song didn't have that. Didn't have the black female vocalists, you know, going Wonder Woman, and the gay nasal sounding. Oh, well, it's raining on you.
Oh, they changed it for the second season because for people that don't know, the original season happened during the Nazi era of World War II.
Correct.
And because when Wonder Woman was kind of developed, she was developed during that era in the comics, and then the second season, or was it the third season? I believe it was the second. They were like, "This, it's too expensive. Nobody cares about World War II anymore. Let's update it to a modern time." And so, you know, Diana Prince comes back and is working in Washington.
Yeah, and, you know, for the Trump administration. She's going to bring him down. But that's actually, you know, it's interesting, too, because I think, like, audiences are really excited about Wonder Woman because we're sort of living under the oppression of this, you know, fascist, sexist monster. And the, you know, Republican administration and the Trump administration is really oppressive. And so there's something really heroic about seeing a strong woman, you know, in the big screen,
right,
leaping out against all odds and adversity, you know, and you really feel like Wonder Woman is in danger. And so it's very satisfying to see this movie. In the 1970s TV show, it was very, Batman was a commercial success.
From the 60s.
From the 60s. And so they wanted to develop their second biggest superhero, or third biggest superhero, was Bat. First it was Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman. And so they wanted to, they had really many failures with turning Superman into a series. I think one of the actors committed suicide. So
from Superman, well, he killed himself. I think after the show went off the air, I believe.
And so that tarnished the brand for some time.
But when you look at Superman from the 50s, though, it's real
depressing.
It's kind of depressing. Well, first of all, it's in black and white, so we would see it in reruns, and it was kind of like boring. Anything was in black and white, like, oh my god, this is so old, even though at that time it was probably 15, 16 years old, but it seemed it was from another era. And so it was just kind of slow paced. And then, you know, you look at Superman, you look at Christopher Reeves, he's gorgeous. You look at
Linda Carter,
you know, the most recent Superman, Henry Cavill, he's gorgeous. And so you've always had these really hot looking men playing Superman, and then the guy you have in in the 1950s was just kind of like, I don't know, he didn't even seem like he was very much in shape. You have better pecs than he does.
It's like Homer Simpson playing Superman, which there is Homer Simpson with a Superman t-shirt, but... and so, you know, with the success of Batman, which had a lot of comedic and Broadway actors playing the villains, they brought in a lot of comedic actors to play the supporting cast. Lyle Wagner played a Major Steve Trevor, which is Wonder Woman's male counterpart, and Cloris Leachman play Hippolyta, her mother, who reluctantly sent her to live amongst the world of mankind. And so in the pilot episode, they have this just totally ridiculous premise, which is, you know, Linda Carter puts on a blonde wig. Because, you know, Paradise Island, you gotta look good. So they had wigs there back then.
And there's, like, so many women living there that you would, like, you know, you would never know that this was her.
And so they have this, you know, contest. And the contest, literally, one of the challenges of the contest is where they pull out guns and they start shooting each other. And they're having to dodge bullets.
Bullets versus bracelets, this is what it's called.
Exactly. and it's between Diana, you know, Linda Carter, and some other actress who doesn't get it, obviously. But she's dodging the bullets. And then one of the bullets hits her. And she's like, ow, like she broke a nail. And so Cloris Leachman turns to Linda Carter, Princess Diana, and says, "You are the winner. You are trusted with the sacred task of going into the world of men." And she's like, "I do this not just because I love my people, but because I love my mother." And she takes her wig off. And everyone goes, "What?" And so,
After that, there was one of the when she sends Diana off to the world of men, it's one of the campiest scenes ever because it's Cloris Leachman giving her her outfit, her golden lasso, and explaining what all these things are. But the whole scene is her in this room that's, you know, overly decorated in some kind of weird Roman Greek style. And the whole scene is just Cloris Leachman going over to an object, touching it in a weird way, feeling it up, and then telling her daughter something, walking over to another object, feeling it up, talking to her daughter some more, walking over someplace. She touches like 10 different things. It's so bizarre.
I must touch these things. Mm-hmm. And Cloris Leachman was Mary Tyler Moore's landlord. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these people were well known.
Well,
at the
she'd
time.
Also been in Young Frankenstein. She'd been in a bunch of Mel Brooks movies. So, and she'd been around for a while.
Frau Vukach, which is on Netflix now. Mm. Linda Carter was a dancer. She was a cast. She's a Mexican American and a strong, wise Latina woman. She came up with the idea of spinning into his transformation because at the time they wanted her just to, you know, change clothes really quickly. And they were like, they needed something visual, kind of like Star Trek's transporter. Or Superman getting into the phone booth.
You got to get the script moving along. You can't just wait and like change.
And so that initially, if you look at the pilot, it's a crossfade, which makes it look like her clothes are melting off her body. And she's doing it in a hallway where a bunch of nurses and doctors are walking. So and no one reacts to it. They're just like, oh, yeah, it's Wonder Woman. Took her clothes off.
And there's an explosion sound, too, right?
No, initially there's not. It's just magical music. And then the theme song started with, you know, an explosion because it's Wonder Woman. And so they used the explosion sound. So every time she transforms, explosion happens and she comes out as Wonder Woman.
Now, in the new movie, there's a couple of times in the movie where you think when she's, you know, going from outfit to, you know, her Wonder Woman out, you think it's going to happen. But it never really happens.
Like,
it's
going
to happen right now. But then you do see some allusions to it, like you see a dress kind of like floating in the wind kind of thing.
The movie borrows a lot from not just the TV series, but obviously the comics. Right. But I'm really glad that some of these characters' qualities made it from the TV series into the film. And Etta Candy, Steve Trevor's secretary, points out, she's like, when Gal Gadot puts on the glasses, like, no one's going to believe that. That's stupid, you know?
Well, Etta must be from the comic books, right? Because I don't remember her from the TV show.
She had a crush on Steve Trevor, and Steve Trevor had a crush on Diana Prince. The series was very hokey very much like Batman. And I think, you know, in hindsight, it could have been taken more serious.
I don't think it was that much like Batman. Although, you know, the people that did make Batman, they did try and do a pilot in 1967. Now, that was trying to be kind of more of a Batman kind of thing. And they just did a screen test for it. So it was only like 5 minute scene. And it's just absolutely terrible.
It's unwatchable.
Yeah, you can watch it because it's only 5 minutes long. But it's just ridiculous. And the concept is Wonder Woman's going to go fight crime. But her mother is bugging her to find a man.
And she's living with her mother.
Yeah.
Because it was ridiculous for Wonder Woman to be a single woman free from Paradise Island. Mm-hmm. So they completely disregarded the character completely.
Yeah, it was so ridiculous. And so you can see now why it was never picked up. But it was weird because the narrator was the same guy who was the narrator for Batman.
Now, the 1970s TV show had a lot of great fashion. They gave Wonder Woman her own scuba diving outfit with the matching stars and stripes, a skateboarding gear outfit, and a motocross jumpsuit. This is especially like in the modern times. She also had a cape. And so when she twirled to transform, the cape would somehow magically appear on her shoulders, and it would give her that a lot of pizzazz and flair.
It's some showmanship.
Now, you as a little kid, did you ever like try to transform as Wonder Woman by spinning around?
Well, we would always play that like when you're playing as a kid, but I mean, how can you really do it? I mean, we probably put like sheets or something like on it, yeah. like throw the sheets off. I'm like, ooh, look underneath. Here I am.
But the first time I actually started trying to do a spin or a pirouette in a dance class, I was always thinking of Wonder Woman.
And so that's the show that we love to watch as kids, but we also saw like Super Friends, you know, that was the show to watch too. So, and they were kind of like right around the same time. It was Super Friends. And then I believe Wonder Woman came on like 67, 76, 78 and stuff.
And originally in the Super Friends, in the comic book series, they had kind of Wonder Woman being the secretary to the Super Friends and didn't actually go on any adventures. Wonder Woman as a comic book character was created by the same guy who created the lie detector test, William Moulton Marston. He was in a three-way relationship with his wife, Elizabeth Marston, and their friend, Olive Byrne, who they introduce as his wife's Elizabeth's sister-in-law. And Olive wore these bracelets that he later on credited with inspiring him to create the character.
Well, and his wife inspired him to make the lie detector, right? Because he was like, she said that every time she gets flustered that her blood pressure goes up. And so he thought to himself, like, hey, that when people lie, their blood pressure goes up. So maybe we can measure that. But he came up with the lasso to force people to tell the truth independently of that, right?
Yeah, so he never previous, subsequent interviews, he said that those two were not connected in any ways, but it's a happy coincidence that the man who created the lie detector also came up with the magic lasso that tells the truth. Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad that, you know, so many of the elements of Wonder Woman made it into this film. I was very I didn't go see it opening weekend. We waited some time.
We waited. Well, we had to work. We had to do some stuff. And I almost wanted to go one night, but then I was just like, oh my God, we're too exhausted. We can't go. So we just saw it the other night. But one of the elements, though, from like the magazine or the comic book when it first came out in the 1940s is Wonder Woman was almost always tied up like in a chair, and she had to escape because this guy was really into S&M and bondage, and that was kind of why he developed this character as like this sex maniac in a way.
Well, I don't think that she was a sex maniac. I think part of it was that it's a bondage fantasy where the superhero inevitably got tied up with her own lasso of truth and had the tables turn on her, which created dramatic tension.
Right.
How she got out of that scenario.
But it was also that kind of constraint, though, too, and that's what people in bondage like. You know, and it harkens back to when you look at the old, like, sword and sandal films of movies about Hercules and whatnot from the 50s and 60s. One of the things that they always did was they would have Hercules or the strong man tied up at his arms, and he'd have to struggle against these ropes, so then you could see all his muscles ripple and you could see all that kind of tension. And of course, eventually he's going to break through of that thing, which is kind of like the climax, is the breaking through.
And I think that's part of Wonder Woman's lasting appeal in a man's world is getting men excited about female empowerment. It's the twist of putting male characters in peril, and that it's okay for women to save the day. Mm. I think, you know,
as long as they're sexy.
Well, I mean, are any, you know, I think in the superhero genre that actually there was a Ball Boy was the one, the only pleasantly plump comic book mm-hmm. character whose superhero was the fact that he was fat.
Listen, and he bounced very hot around to some people.
It was, but you know, it's like a superhero developers mm-hmm. and creators actually been very criticized in the fact that they're all like muscular bodybuilder, sure. yeah. male and female archetypes,
giant big pecs or big boobs, little tiny waist, you know, plump butts and stuff. Because you know, sex sells, so that's what they try and sell.
Well, and I think it's an ideal, mm-hmm. and it's based on this Greek ideal mm-hmm. and something. And you know, a lot of there's also something about the comic book superheroes are in some ways a Jewish archetype of the Gollum, mm-hmm. Not Gollum from My Precious, mm-hmm. the Ring from, but Gollum is a superhero made out of clay that comes and saves the people from the bad guys. Mm-hmm. Right.
And it was developed by the Jewish people that lived in the ghetto in Prague. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of like this,
it's a fable.
Yeah. It's a fable. And then this guy to inspire people. And it was also, you know, a story you could tell your kids about this thing that came to life, and which is kind of interesting. You say that, and that Wonder Woman is a golem herself, because they say that she was forged from clay.
Well, and I would say that all superhero, the concept mm-hmm. of a superhero itself is a Jewish storytelling narrative or device. And so, you know, we owe Jewish culture for giving us the superhero, right? And so, because sometimes people are like, this is really twisted, this is negative and dark. And I'm like, think of this as, you know, this is a hero to come in and save us when all fails, when everything, when we live in a terrible world with terrible things happening around us. And sometimes it's great to fantasize, mm-hmm. to escape and dream of somebody or someone coming in and
that's with like
standing up against oppression.
In the Bible, you have King David, who was like, he was basically a nobody, and he comes into town and he kills the giant. He kills Goliath. And so, and then he becomes king and has a very long reign, and you know, people absolutely adored him. And then you have somebody like Samson, who had this beautiful long hair, and he was super, super strong. And then when his hair was cut, then he became like a weakling. So these kids, you know, the Jewish kids grow up on these stories, and I think it inspires like, what new stories can we tell for today? But I wonder, let me ask you, this is like, as little gay boys, what is it about Wonder Woman that is so appealing to you?
She was fun.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I think the athletic boys we were kind of in love with, and they were also a source of our torment. You know, mm-hmm. we were turned on by them and oppressed by mm-hmm. them. And so the Wonder Woman was just freedom. She was a pure joy, and she was unstoppable. And so she was everything great about a superhero with any mm-hmm. of the negative masculine mm-hmm. associations that were hurting us as little mm-hmm. gay boys.
I think for us, you know, for little gay boys, I think sometimes it's, you know, some of our biggest champions were our sisters or our friends who were girls, because a lot of them could stand up to the bullies and say things to the bullies that would kind of like shut them down, because they were used to that themselves mm-hmm. in some ways, having to deal with these horrible men in their lives. And so I think I liked Wonder Woman particularly because of that, and also because, you know, I idolized her because she had that, you know, feminine quality, and it was like, I like boys too. And so I think, you know, gay boys have some of that femininity within them too. And I think that, you know, she had a very sharp tongue, especially when you look at like the cartoons and even in the this movie.
She talked back.
She talked back, and she didn't put up with stuff. And in some ways, you know, she very much was a princess.
Yeah, she was entitled in the sense that didn't realize that there were consequences mm-hmm. for talking back.
Right. And so I think that definitely has an appeal to gay guys, because we're known for our sharp tongues.
And I think William Moulton Marston, in a lot of ways, it created that character, not necessarily to inspire gay men, but understanding the universal appeal of a strong woman who comes in to save mm-hmm. the day. And so here's a quote of this is Linda Carter on the pilot episode talking to Stella Stevens, who was a Nazi who was equally matched with her. And if they go through this sort of campy, you know, fight scene, and she finally ties up Stella Stevens mm-hmm. in the chair, and she turns to Stella and says, "Any civilization that does not recognize the female is doomed to destruction. Women on the wave of the future. And sisterhood is stronger than anything. All right, come on.
Well, back when the TV show aired, though, too, is like we didn't really know like what Wonder Woman's superpowers were, really. In some ways, we just kind of thought like she was a highly athletic woman, that she was just trained, you know, kind of much like Batman in a sense, because we didn't know if her parentage was from Greek gods or not. But I guess what is in the Crisis of Infinite Earths or something that happened in the 90s, they kind of rewrote her storyline so that she was, you know, a child of Zeus.
She's a demigod.
She's a demigod. And so she basically has pretty much the same powers as like Superman. Like she can fly and, you know, she's super strong. She can heal and she's immortal.
And she's made out of clay. The 1970s TV show hadn't rewritten her to be this demigod yet. And so a lot of the plots, especially for the second and third season, involved her losing the charms that she had, her bracelets or her magic belt that gave her super strength or her ability to jump really high. Mm. And so it didn't follow a lot of logic. And so one episode I remember very clearly, her magic belt that gave her super strength got taken off her somehow. And these kids rescued Wonder Woman by tying it around a tree trunk and using the tree trunk that now had super strength to break down a fence. And I'm like, why don't you just put it around your waist, kid? Now you're Wonder Woman, you know? It's like, so Wonder Woman was really just her charms. It was kind of sexist, this idea, you know? And so because we love Wonder Woman so much, it, you know, in a lot of ways, Gal Gadot and this film, it's like being reunited with an old friend. Mm. I was so apprehensive. I just didn't even want to see it because I didn't want to have my heart broken. I didn't want Linda Carter's beautiful face in her, mm-hmm. and this iconic image of female strength tarnished mm-hmm. by this sloppy, greedy corporation that did such a terrible job mm-hmm. with Batman v Superman.
Well, and also too, remember they tried to come out with a pilot for a TV show, Wonder Woman, in 2011, which was written by David E. Kelly, and uh-huh. it never even saw the light of day. You could find it on the internet. There's some places you can BitTorrent it or whatever and watch it, because it did get leaked, and it was just terrible, because they tried to give Wonder Woman three identities. Wonder Woman, and then they
being
Diana Prince, and she had like a makeup company, and then she had another one, which was like her other alter ego, so she could just be kind of like a normal girl that didn't really like have a job and just hung out and had a boyfriend. And like her nemesis was Elizabeth Hurley, who owned like a rival makeup company. It's absolutely terrible.
And of course, you know, had to be makeup. Mm-hmm. Could be like, I do like Mythals. You know, the gal, you know, Patty Jenkins' mm-hmm. take on Wonder Woman now is making her into this intellectual, this almost timeless person who won't ever fall in love again because, you know, she's immortal.
Oh, she'll fall in love again with Batman.
Maybe. We don't know.
He's trying to prime that pump.
Yeah, because they're dating in the Batman v Superman. They were like flirting with mm-hmm. each other. And, you know, so let's talk about the movie. And,
sure.
and this is a lot of spoiler alert. So if you don't want to, if you haven't seen the movie yet, I really urge you guys to go see it. It's as perfect as a superhero movie can mm-hmm. get. It's right up there with the first Guardians of the Galaxy. Mm-hmm.
Some people aren't liking it. We'll get to some of the things that they have problems with, for sure.
And so they interviewed Patty Jenkins about why didn't she use Linda Carter at least to make a cameo? She could have been one of the, you know, Amazons.
Mm-hmm. Sure, something.
And she was just like, oh, you know, I just, she was just, you know.
You want to see, in some ways I understand it, because you want to just kind of take a break from it. And let's be honest, it's like Linda Carter is a campy actress. And it doesn't matter what
she's a cabaret star.
Yeah, but what other kind of, you know, when you put her in a movie like this, because you have, you know, her mother is a Danish in the movie, Wonder Woman's mother is a Danish actress. And then her aunt who teaches her how to do is like Robin Wright. And these are respected actresses who have like probably been nominated for Oscars and things, or have won Oscars. And so when you have somebody like Linda Carter, it might in some ways cheapen the movie a little bit.
It would have been nice to, even if she was just in the background, or, you know,
doing something
on the island.
Or like maybe they'll do like they did with in Baywatch or something, like they'll probably put them in like part two. If there's a part two, maybe they'll have her do something then.
Because at the end of the titles of the movie, they thanked Linda Carter for informing and inspiring the movie. And in many ways, the way we think about Wonder Woman as a character, we owe so much to Linda Carter. You know, and I think, you know, driving home, and I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but Wonder Woman's ultimate secret power is being able to turn a hawk into a dove to stop a war with love.
Aww.
And make a liar tell the truth, as the theme song says. And I think you're going to see a lot of that in this movie.
Well, with, you know, Patty Jenkins, too, is like she didn't, Gal Gadot was not her pick, or Gadot was not her pick to do it, because Zack Snyder picked her for her small role in Batman v Superman.
She didn't want her.
She didn't want her. She didn't even really know her. She wanted the option to pick her own person, but she actually told Playboy that, this is a quote, "I remember when I read in the news that Wonder Woman had been cast, and my heart sank. I had been talking to the studio for so long about doing it, and I was like, well, that's that. I'm sure we wouldn't have made the same choice. And then she goes, frankly, I think they did a better job than I could have, because I don't know that I would have scoured the earth as hard to find her. The fact that they found Gal and chose her is a magical gift to me. They're incredibly intelligent people, and they were looking for all the same things I would have looked for, all the values that Wonder Woman stands for, exuding from someone in an honest way, and boy, did they find it. She's the greatest."
You know, and Gal is a beauty pageant.
Miss Israel?
Miss Israel. You know, so it's easy to dismiss her as just a pretty face, but, you know, God, what a gorgeous woman.
Well, and she almost gave up on acting, too, and then she...
It was her last attempt.
It was her last attempt, and they called her for a bunch of auditions, and then she got the role and was like, wow. But, you know, this movie, they'd been talking about Wonder Woman making this movie for a long time, and I feel like they were really worried about the production schedule. I feel like it wasn't supposed to be like released last year or something, and then it was like only released this year, and so people were really talking like they're like, this movie could really tank, and especially when you've seen like the Superman films and the Batman films of
Suicide
late.
Suicide Squad, and what piece of garbage that was.
Yeah. Hey, it won an Oscar.
For what, not costumes. Being garbage?
Yeah. Oscar winning film, The Suicide Squad.
So let's talk about the plot of the movie.
Sure. So Steve Trevor is escaping the Germans. He crash lands outside of Themyscira, which he calls Paradise Island because it's filled with women. I personally would call it hell if I had to stay there for an extended period of time. Now,
it feels like the Michigan Women's Music Festival with muscle.
With muscles and swords.
And muscles stuff. And swords. Yeah. And you know, let's just, Gal Gadot is the hottest woman on the island.
Without a doubt. Well, also, too. And so we kind of see a little bit of her backstory there, too. We see her as a little girl, and she's the only child on this island. So we're all kind of like, where'd this little girl come from, and who are these women? And they tell a story about how the Amazons were created by the gods to help mankind in times of war, and that they had a big fight between Zeus, who is the father of the gods, and Ares, who is the god of war, and so they were able to defeat Ares, and so they retreated to this island to spend, you know, an eternity. But Hippolyta had wanted a child so badly, she created this figure out of clay, and she prayed to Zeus, and then Zeus made this child come to life. And so Diana grew up on this island. The mother didn't want her to like learn how to fight because she was afraid of what might happen if she learned how to fight. Because we kind of get this sense that there's something special about Diana, and so Diana rescues Steve Trevor and brings him into the fold, and then they're trying to decide what to do because Steve's like, there's a whole war going out there, and Diana's just like, we have to stop the war. And so she leaves Themyscira with him to London, and in London they figure out like, hey, we have to go behind enemy lines and we have to find out what they're doing.
So when the earth was flat and the clouds were made of fire and mountains stretched up to the sky, sometimes higher.
And then Hedwig there.
Then Zeus said, I want to kill them all with my hammer like I killed the giants. And you'd never lose my lightning like scissors. I cut off the legs off the whales and dinosaurs into lizards. Will we see in Wonder Woman, like, Zeus make show up and have, like, you know, men, you know, people with two eyes and two sets of heads? And
we don't see that, but we do see some kind of like love and some animation that's more like drawings. Like, you'd see, like, Michelangelo had drawn, like, God on the Sistine Chapel. So we see, like, a Zeus-like figure like that. But we also see as Diana, when she is kind of going, doing something in Themyscira that she's not supposed to, she jumps across this huge gorge to get into this building because she wants to take something from this building. We do see an ox there, a bull, and sometimes Zeus, when he would come down,
make himself manifest on Earth,
manifest as a bull, sometimes as an eagle, or as many different things,
or as a cloud,
or as a cloud.
And he fucked women as a cloud by getting inside their pussy as steam. There's a great painting of Zeus making love to a woman,
and so we see like one of her first great shows of her like super like strength is in front of this in front of this cow, in front of this bull, and so I was just like, oh, because Zeus supposedly is dead from that war. But then, like, how could he have made her after he died? And why is this bull here? So I think Zeus is still a thing.
The bull was also like a campy moment because it was like, what is she doing here? What are you doing? So there's, you know, I think to me, the movie really shines when she finally makes her way to World War One England, and she's forced to reconcile her idea, her paradise island, her heritage with this dirty, gritty, barbaric, sexist society, and you know, this fish out of water story is actually really compelling. And I think, you know, Patty Jenkins had a lot of wisdom to flesh that out, which is something we've never really seen in other types of portrayals of Wonder Woman in animation or in television or in film.
Because, you know, it's her origin story. You're like, so, you know, she's on this island. What is she going to expect when she goes out into this world? How is she going to react to these things? You know, there's a scene where she sees a baby. She's never seen a baby before because she was the only child on that island.
It would be like the first time you saw a puppy. You want to pet it, you know? If you see the first time you see a baby, you're like, oh my God.
And there's, like, you know.
And I think that, you know, the scene where she's actually licking the ice cream and she says, you must be very proud to the ice cream vendor. That actually is from the comic book. And it actually is already been done several times in the animated series.
So
that little
an ice
joke.
Cream licker.
She likes a liquor cone. I feel so close to this movie that I don't want to give too much around. But let me just say, Diana tastes the pleasures of mankind, if you know what I'm saying, in the form of a CGI enhanced Chris Pine, who they have a very gratuitous scene where he's in a jacuzzi on Paradise Island, and you get to see almost everything except his dick.
Because he covers that up with his hand.
And she goes, is that dick supposed to be big? And he goes, it's 12 inches. How's she going to check?
Do you even know what a ruler is?
Yeah, they don't even have rulers on Paradise Island. So it's a fun film. Go see it. The slow motion films, which feels very, you know, overused to... you know, the Matrix style animation fight scenes. You said that they really remind you of?
It definitely reminds you of the comic books, because like when you're seeing fighting in the comic books, you just see a still, and so it's nice to see something slowed down because you can really take it all in. And of course, there's some ridiculous moments, especially when the Amazons are fighting. We're like, really, you're gonna shoot three arrows all at once, and they're all gonna hit their target?
I thought that was so much fun.
Yeah, it was absolutely a lot of fun.
And
you know, the Amazons too is like, you know, they are based on real women from Greek mythology or Greek history. They were women, I guess they were fighters, and they were on horseback.
Do you know what the word Amazon means?
What does it mean?
One boob.
Because they were rumored to cut off one of their boobs because it would get in the way of their using arrows.
Swords and
arrows. Now, I watched one of those TV shows on the History Channel where they traced DNA, and they dug up what they thought was like an Amazon grave. And so this would have been just north of Greece and to the right, because the Amazons were nomadic horseback women. And so they looked at the clothing that this person was still wearing in their grave, and the jewelry and whatnot. And so they were able to identify some of those same remnants in some of the cultures in Mongolia. And so they went along Mongolia, because these women, these Amazons, were supposed to be like blonde haired, blue eyed women. And so they found a young girl living in Mongolia who looked Asiatic, you know, with Mongolian fold on her eyes, basically looked, you know, Chinese, except she had very light hair. It was very blonde. And so they did do a genetic test on her, and she was related to the person that was buried in that gravesite.
And she also had a Wonder Woman logo on her, which now thanks to Patty Jenkins' movie, the WW is just a graphical element of Amazonian culture and does not. And there is like WW. Why not Wonder Woman? Well, whatever.
I think that's part of the reason, because, you know, we think about Wonder Woman and her origin story as being World War II with the Nazis. And I think that her Amazon heritage and these women riding on horseback was part of the reason why they set it in World War One, because in World War One, they were still using horses in the war, and people were still getting around on horseback. And so you do see her on horseback quite a bit, trying to get around and doing things. And that was part of one of the big failures of the German army, and why they did lose that war, because they heavily invested their money into the cavalry, into horses, whereas the English and the French and whatnot, they put it into tanks and into cars.
What about Fausta, the Nazi Wonder Woman in this movie? She's kind of the Phantom of the Opera. She has a ceramic mask hiding her disfigurement.
Well, her name was Dr. Maru, and so I was just kind of like, and I thought it was kind of interesting that it was Mars, because Maru, because Mars is the Roman version of Ares, the same, the god of war. So I was thinking, because the whole plot is that, you know,
she's searching for Ares.
She's searching for Ares, because once she kills Ares, the war will be over, because he's the, you know, like the guy who makes war happen. And so I was thinking that maybe it was her because of her name.
You kept throughout the movie like, it's the doctor, it's the lady. No, you were saying it like twice or something, three times, and then people turned to you like, will you shut the fuck up?
That's not true.
There was people sitting next to us who started crying, not during the emotional or romantic scenes, but during the war moments, when finally Wonder Woman stands up in a battlefield. It's the strength of a woman standing up against justice in a world and succeeding. And I started researching it online. A lot of people were very moved by this image. That something we really don't get to see is a box office smash hit where a woman stands up against adversity and succeeds in such a bold way. And so, you know, right wingers are like, liberals like war when it's, you know, Wonder Woman. Right wing, you know, they're trying to, you know, because people who, you know, Republicans and Trump supporters share one thing in common, a couple things in common, is that they don't like other people having the things that they have. That's a key thing to their psychology. They're very selfish people, and, you know, enjoying an ice cream cone isn't enough. You have to make sure that the people around you don't have an ice cream cone. The second thing is, because of that mentality, other people, you know, it's a man's world. Women and other minorities cannot enjoy that ice cream cone, cannot get access to that ice cream cone. And so a lot of them are very threatened by the success of Wonder Woman. And so they're using it as a right-wing propaganda piece to talk about the hypocrisy of what they call everybody else. They you know, anybody who doesn't agree or believe their selfishness, they call them liberals or the left. So whenever you see like a discussion framed as right versus left, even if it's a progressive or pretends to be progressive media, it's a Trump, it's a Republican concept to think about selfishness as a two sides of a political coin. And ultimately, you know, it's like, this idea that you cannot enjoy seeing a woman succeed or be strong in a film is ultimately ties itself to this idea that you can't, you're very threatened by the very idea of somebody else doing better than you.
Mm.
And especially that person that you've ascribed to be is inferior.
Well, and also too, is like when you look at like, there's how many men were actually upset that they had an all women screening at the Alamo Draft House in Austin, Texas of Wonder Woman. You know, there's probably maybe a handful of tweets, but gosh, did the media blow it up? It's like there was this angry mob of men who felt excluded. And like most people probably just looked at that and just like, were like, whatever. So a bunch of girls want to go see a movie. Who cares? But there was, you know, three or four guys that were like, I'm excluded, I'm discriminated against, I'm this and I'm that. And they just kind of blow it up out of proportion. It's just like, nobody really cares.
It's back to this idea. Mm-hmm. It's like, if I can't have access to something, then nobody can.
Well, and also, too, is like when you look at that and put that up against like the feminist backlash against something like Ghostbusters, like this movie just hasn't had it like Ghostbusters had. And I don't know if that's because Wonder Woman was always a feminist kind of thing and Ghostbusters was just, you know, a movie.
Well, I think Ghostbusters failed because it had a bad director and a bad screenwriter.
But I'm talking about the marketing behind it, though, too. And I think
Wonder Woman succeeded because it's a good movie. Mm-hmm. And it had a good director and it had a good script and it had a strong, appealing, you know, actor. I would argue that Ghostbusters also had strong, appealing actors, but they were just given garbage to work with. And so, you know, Ghostbusters, they had nothing better to do than turn it into this. If you don't like Ghostbusters, you're a sexist pig. Mm-hmm. And so the marketing of Ghostbusters gave rise to Milo, you know, blah, 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 you know,
right.
This jerk.
Well, because Sony kind of like played that up too, because they're like, let's use this, and they astroturfed the hell out of all that garbage to get people talking about the film.
And that's why I was so apprehensive and so nervous about Wonder Woman, because I was worried that we were going to get part two of this.
Mm-hmm.
But Wonder Woman was a good movie.
But you know, some people aren't liking it. There was one writer for Afropunk who talked about the portrayal,
which is a right wing African American blog.
It is?
Yes. I researched it.
Oh my God, I had no idea. Yeah. Well, the one point that they made that I picked up on, and maybe there was other points that I missed, but the one was that they felt like the black characters in the movie that you saw on Paradise Island or Themyscira, that they were just basically mammies to Diana. They didn't really add anything to the story, that they were just kind of portrayed as like very, very like tertiary characters, and they were just caregivers, and that's about it.
Well, we haven't seen what a lot of these characters actually are from the comic books, and they make their way into the world of men as well, and they get involved in future adventures of Wonder Woman. So if the film has legs, and it, you know, after this, it's going to
look
continue.
At her legs, baby.
Rawr.
Well, and also too,
those characters are not subservient. Mm-hmm. This is a right wing propaganda piece.
Afropunk is
yes, it is.
I had no idea.
It's also too,
the person Robin Wright who trains Diana, she's going to be in Justice League. So I don't know how they're going to do it. If it's going to be a flashback, or maybe, you know, spoiler alert, she was injured in battle and survived, or did she die? Who knows? Or maybe Zeus will bring her back to life.
I wanted to do a shout out to Uta Adepo, who was in the credits. She has five O's in her name.
No, I saw that. I was like, what's that name?
Five O's, T-A, and then A-D-E-P-O. As of taping on this podcast, she has 37 followers on Twitter. And she deserves more attention, so go follow her on Twitter.
Well, and some other people that don't like the film, too, is like they're very upset that Gal Gadot has been chosen to play Wonder Woman because she's Israeli, and people are very unhappy with she's Israeli, and so she's pro-Israeli because she's from Israel and served in the Israeli army, and the people are very concerned about the way Israel treats the Palestinian people.
Native Americans approve of the movie. And we might even see one of the Native American character, Chief, played by Eugene Brave Rock, introduces himself to her as Napi.
How do you spell that?
Not Nappy, like your hair. N-A-P-I, the Blackfoot demigod, who's known as a trickster and storyteller. And so we might see him make an appearance in future Justice League movies.
Oh, because like, what did they have in like Justice League, the cartoon? They had the Apache chief, right?
Yeah.
And all he did was like, he grew big, and that's it. And so when I first saw him, I'm like, is he a little bigger in this scene than he was in the last one? But so you're saying he's like trickster, huh?
He's a trickster. Yeah. He's a Blackfoot demigod.
Who's the other trickster in the one that plays the
Hopi?
Coco Pelli, that's it too.
Yeah, but that's a different thing.
Southwest,
he's a masturbation too. It's about a
what?
Yeah, Coco Pelli's a for a while, like, he was a gay symbol for a gay Native Americans, and the idea of a spiral, a double spiral is male and female, and a single spiral going in a certain direction was a Native American symbol for a homosexual.
Oh, so Nappy, though, he was Blackfoot. I had an ancestor that married a Blackfoot, and then we never heard from him again.
And please, you know, I'm just pulling this out of my memory that I learned in college in a Native American art class 25 years ago. So I may be wrong. Sorry,
well, Coco Pelli was like, he was big in the 90s. He had like a weird resurgence, right?
It was, you know, it was, I think like postmodernism got a lot of people excited about Native American art. And so, like, if you look at the floor in Pee Wee's Playhouse, it's basically, there's a lot of Hopi and Anasazi designs. Because the Southwest just was really hot at the time, and just people loved that black and white checkerboard pattern and those, vase designs and those textures and ideas. And so, and those Kachina dolls and all that stuff made its way into popular culture. So go see Wonder Woman. It's a fantastic film. I'm sure DC Comics is breathing a sigh of relief. This is the hit they wanted with the Batman and Superman franchise, and they finally got a film that works. The reason it worked is because they put thought into it. They rewrote it many times with the same writers, and they put a strong female in charge. I'm not talking about Gal Gadot. I'm talking about Patty Jenkins. So Patty Jenkins gets a lot of the credit for the success of this film.
Without a doubt.
Can definitely. I get an amen? I mean, an A woman up in here.
I have to say that one thing, too, is like, before we stop talking about this, is the biggest cheer that happened is when we first see Wonder Woman come out in her Wonder Woman costume, because we see her in all different kinds of costumes. And then when she enters the battlefield, and it was like a lot of the women around us were just like, yes, like they were so excited to see that costume. And it was just like, I was, you know, excited to see it, too. But like, I was more enthused that they were so enthused, because I was just like, okay, well, we've seen costumes and like, this is their take on it. But they, that really struck a chord with them.
Well, and I hated the fact that they had turned Wonder Woman's costume, which is this, you know, bright, you know, eagle around her boobs and this bikini.
Red, white, and blue. Yeah.
And they turned it into this sort of like earth tone leather thing for the Batman v Superman. So they went back to at least muted red, white, and gold. I'm sorry, red, gold, and blue colors for this movie, because I think that really is where Wonder Woman should be. You know, it's just a beautiful colors and ideas, and it's so much fun. And
now, Faust, you say in our intro, you have a Chris Pratt has become a gay porn star. What's up with that?
So this is a thing that people are doing now, is like, you know, your favorite Hollywood icons or, you know, and they're finding photos of them just kind of hanging outside what look like the beginnings to a gay porn film. And so they're cropping it and they're putting like Sean Cody or, you know, men.com or hothouse.com or whatever. They're putting the logos of these gay porn companies on top of it. And everyone's like, oh my God, Chris Pratt is a porn star. You know, so it gets everybody's excited about it. So if you could go to our Feast of Fun group, friends of the show, you can see the image of Chris Pratt as a gay porn star. And I said, and when I was just like, so what? Like, I didn't realize it was Chris Pratt. I just looked at it and I was like,
Another cute porn.
Oh, it's just another cute porn star. Why is everybody getting so excited about this? I'm like, oh.
Oh, it's Chris Pratt looking like a porn star.
Guardians of the Butthole Galaxy.
Well, his co-star in Guardians of the Galaxy, Dave Bautista, recently tweeted, proud son of a lesbian, and anyone who has issue with that can suck my balls.
Yeah, and, Chris Pratt in 2014 promoting the first Guardians of the Galaxy, the movie, was asked about fan/fiction about people imagining there being a threesome with Chris Evans and Robert Downey Jr. And so BuzzFeed was interviewing him and says, I think people think you guys are super hot and you should all be hooking up with each other. Mm-hmm. Chris Pratt said, like me, Chris Evans and Robert Downey Jr., I have to say, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see Chris Pratt and Chris Evans making out. That would be nice.
That'd be real nice. Can we can we get that to happen?
If you have a lot of money.
Do you want to be in this next film? You have to fuck him in front of me.
I don't know. It's like
there's that casting couch in Hollywood. Who knows if it's already been done?
Well, you know, Chris Pine, according to Wonder Woman, has a big dick, so.
Yeah, he just said above average.
Above average.
You an average man.
Yeah, because on the island of Paradise Island, they don't have a ruler, mm-hmm. so it could be anything.
Well, they do have a queen, though.
What's this weird thing that everybody's talking about? Pride. It's the Gabagoobu.
Badadook.
Badadook. Duke.
So the Badadook is an Australian film. It came out in 2014. And, you know, it did okay. But it's a story about a little kid and his mom. They move into this house. They read this book about the Badadook and or Babadook. And
what is the Babadook? It's like the boogeyman.
It's a monster. It's a boogeyman. Yeah. Yes. And so the more the mother doesn't believe in it, the stronger it gets. And so once she kind of starts to believe that it's real, then it kind of loses some of its power.
And then so it's an allegory for a mother denying homosexuality in her ex-husband or her son. We don't really know.
We're not really sure about that. But the thing is like somehow it got categorized in Netflix under the LGBT section. And so now
it was a horror film.
A horror film. So now people are celebrating it as like, hey, you know, this is
a gay pride symbol.
Yes. And so now people are just like, this is the thing to wear. Now, our friend Jojo, they did, I think, at Queen, which is a night that they do on Sunday nights. He did a look like that for
Mr.
All
Baby.
Mr. Jojo Baby is his
Jojo
name, yes.
Baby is an entertainer named Jojo Baby.
Mm-hmm. And he's been on the podcast many, many years ago. A couple of different times.
The word faggot tattooed on his stomach.
Mm-hmm.
In case you're wondering.
You're like, is he gay or not? Let me see his stomach.
Yeah. Oh!
He's not the only person I know that has faggot tattooed across his stomach like that either.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think JoJo came up with it or you know,
he's
somebody.
The first person I know to have it done, but I know other people that also have it done as well.
And every time I see them, I go, oh, just like JoJo Baby. And they're just like, gee, thanks. And I'm like, it's exactly like Mr. Baby's tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Baby. You have a faggot tattoo on your stomach.
So people are like, oh, yes, I want him as the Grand Marshal of my parade. And they're putting him up against rainbow backgrounds and whatnot. So it'll be this for like the next 4 days.
Orange is the New Black's Leah Delaria is our Grand Marshal here in Chicago. Finally, somebody I recognize.
Mm-hmm.
God, so many years to just have some like, you know, everybody goes, who?
And you're like, what?
You know, it's some random person you never heard of. And you're just like, oh, God. So Leah Delaria, who's hilarious. I'm going to try to get her on the podcast. If you're hearing, Leah, we want to get you on the
show. Come on down, girl, to the Feast of Fun.
Princess Leah Delaria.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's going to lay you, honey. Hilarious jokes. What's a Tin Man getting the DWI?
Well, he was hired to portray the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz at an event.
An actor, yes,
in Sullivan, New York. And I guess he got drunk after the event and then was driving, or he was intoxicated somehow because he got a DWI. And so his mugshot is him with like a silver face on. And he's actually a good looking dude.
He's like, a little bit of oil on my dick.
So he was at the Yellow Brick Casino in Chittenango, and then they hired him to play that. And I guess he got a DWI afterwards.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind washing his silver makeup off his face. Didn't like Buddy Ebsen, the what is it, from the Beverly Hillbillies, mm-hmm. the father?
Yeah, he was the original Tin Man, but he had a super horrible reaction to that makeup. It was absolutely, it was like terrifying for him.
I think it was actually ground aluminum.
Or lead?
Or lead or some horrible thing.
Yeah.
Which I think led the filmmakers who made the movie Goldfinger to use that as a way to kill somebody, which is to cover them in gold paint.
Which they actually say is you can't really kill somebody like that.
But you make them sick.
Is that right?
I mean, you know, like I was a metal worker in my early days in college. I worked in gold and aluminum and brass and nickel and that metal just kind of rubs on your fingers and you start tasting in your mouth and I'm like, this can't be good for me, you know? And sometimes when I worked a lot with, especially like, cause there's a lot of volatile chemicals and arsenic and all sorts of nasty shit. Mm-hmm. I would get like a headache.
Oh
like,
yeah.
So
you don't want to breathe that stuff in.
So I was just like, oh, God.
You need ventilation for that kind of stuff.
And that's why I got into performance art, and that's why we're doing a podcast today.
Yay!
Instead of me going, I have a metal cancer allergy. Because I've been making rings for the last 30 years.
Cyndi Lauper is going to write the score for a Broadway production of the 1980s feminist classic film Working Girl. Frog in her throat.
So Melanie Griffith in the movie Working Girl coughs a lot.
She coughs a lot. There's an artist in our neighborhood, Chuck, who edited the movie down to every time Melanie Griffith clears her throat. And I want to say the video, it's called Frog in Her Throat, Working Girl on YouTube. And I feel like it's like 2 or 3 minutes long, if I'm not mistaken. And it's kind of weird because you don't really notice it during the film. I never did. But like afterwards, after you see this thing, you're like, my God, why is she always clearing her throat?
Well, there was that great song that was associated with the movie Working Girl. Mm-hmm. Do you remember it?
No.
Let the river run, da 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 da. This is the new Jerusalem.
Sounds kind of.
Da, 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 da. So that song probably is going to make it into the movie, and that's it'll be good. Yeah. I still like the my favorite movie to musical adaptation is 9 to 5. Because Dolly Parton figured out how to be involved in it by videotaping herself every now and then, be like, oh my God, did you just see that? Like she narrates the musical via video projection. Right.
Well, I wonder too, because like if it's going to be one of those, what they call like a jukebox musical, where they're just going to take songs and just kind of force them into it instead of writing whole new songs. Because those, I guess, do really well with audiences because they don't want to get used to new music. They want just like old classics. And so there'll probably be a bunch of 80s hits and just put them in there.
We want to remind you guys that Feast of Fun is made possible because of generous support of fantastic, fabulous listeners like you. We couldn't do this show with ferociousness, with style, with valor, without you. Go to feastoffun.com/plus and make a contribution because your money helps make the show possible.
And if you'd like to make a one-time donation, you can do that at feastoffun.com/donate, and every penny goes to producing the show. It costs a lot of money to keep these microphones going, computers, mixers, and everything. Everything needs to be upgraded from time to time.
It's called a hard drive. And it gets uploaded to the internet. You know the internet. It's where all your favorite porn movies are found.
And podcasts like Feast of Fun.
That's right.
And don't forget to visit our store, feastoffun.com/store. We got some nice Pride t-shirts. Order them now so you have them for Pride.
Pride, y'all's coming.
It's here.
Yes. Thank you guys so much for listening. And remember, love is stronger than hate. Any society that does not recognize the feminine is doomed to destruction. Women are the wave of the future, and sisterhood is stronger than anything. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye-bye.